On today's episode of The Good Word, Dan Titus joins me to discuss the collapse last night issued by the Oklahoma City Thunder. How great is this team? What happens for the Minnesota Timberwolves coming up next? They have some questions. And we talk about the New York Knicks and Indiana Pacers game five and looking ahead. How much on the hot seat is Coach Tibbs going to be? All that and a little bit more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. A bit of business before we get into today's show. Of course, we are on YouTube, so don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us there, as well as all the places you consume your audio podcast. I'm back home. I'm tired as hell. Minnesota, if y'all was just going to not show up, you'd have been better off being swept. My man Dan Titus, how you doing?
Doing good, Vin. How you feel?
Tired. Just tired. This is the point of the NBA season or playoff run where you're like, do I want a competitive series or do I want to go home?
And so you should be saying thank you to the Thunder. Thank you for taking care of business, giving me a couple more days to kind of chill out and reset before the finals start.
Yeah, in theory, right? But my whole thing is, don't tease me like that, Minnesota Timberwolves. You know what I mean? Because I got to spend, this is going to sound like, you know, very first world problems. I got to spend like 7 days in Oklahoma City for the start of the NBA Finals. Because the Finals begin a week from today on Thursday. You got to get there 2 days before because media day and everything else and the games are so spread out. It's like you're there for a whole week. Let's get that out the way before we even get there. They waxed the Timberwolves last night. I'm sure everybody knows that. I don't know, Titus, are you young enough to know the 40 minutes of hell reference, or are you too young for that?
40 minutes of hell. I don't think I got that one.
Okay. Nolan Richardson coached Arkansas college basketball.
Oh, you taking it way back. All right.
Yeah. This is like 90s. Like me saying 90s.
I don't know college basketball in the 90s. That I know for sure.
That's when I really knew college basketball because dude stayed there and wasn't, you know, flip-flopping right. All over the place.
Right.
But Nolan Richardson had this, like, hellacious defense, and he called it 40 minutes of hell, right? Arkansas beat Duke in 94. That was the Grand Hill team without Christian Laettner, without Bobby Hurley. Beat him with Corliss Williamson. Corliss Williamson was the MVP. Corliss Williamson was assistant coach of Minnesota now. Funny how the world works. But their defense was so hellacious, they just put you in a pressure cooker. This Oklahoma City defense, this might be one of the 2 to 3 best defenses I've seen in the modern NBA. By modern NBA, I mean by the way the game's being played today, Titus, as far as you're spreading out, you're taking a lot of threes, like that sort of thing. The first Kevin Durant iteration of the Golden State Warriors, with you still got Draymond, you still got Klay on 2 healthy legs. KD might have been the best defender, you know, or most versatile defender on earth, along with Draymond Green, right? Mm-hmm. That's pretty damn good. Boston, I think last year's, their defense was really, really good. The Lakers in 2020, quietly, that defense was really good too, but that was more rim protection as opposed to we just going to lock you up. These boys don't even let you get the inbound passes. They don't let you make entry passes. They don't let you do a damn thing. And they're relentless. You got Lou Dort. You got Jalen Williams. You got Alex Caruso, who, in the ultimate compliment from Anthony Edwards, said he almost plays like Draymond Green. He can play small ball 5. Alex Caruso and Draymond Green have next to nothing in common beyond the physical. Okay, y'all? But that's how tough of a dude that he is. I wonder, does that translate to the TV from afar? Because it translates in the building. Do you see that? Do you feel that? The way that the defense is just, they're in your chest, arms, limbs, and you get nothing easy and you go nowhere.
That's all I saw all series long, man. Like every time. It's interesting because I listened to the stars after the game and seeing how they're like going to make their adjustments or what they could do differently. It was consistent the entire series was like, I'm going to see some. I can't get through anything. I got to make the right basketball play. That's how much that defense was in his face. They're constantly making him defer. And then even when he needs to be aggressive, he can't. They lock down the paint. If you look at his numbers in the restricted area in the first two series, he was getting to the restricted area like 8-9 times a game. That was cut off with the Oklahoma City Thunder. And when you look at the statistics of like what Oklahoma City does, man, their perimeter defense is outstanding. I mean, they got like four guys that are averaging 2 steals a game. And when you look at their offensive discipline, they don't turn over the ball a lot. And then you look at how much they're turning their opponents over. There's like a plus 100 differential. That's the most in postseason history. So, yeah, it translates on screen. It probably translates live. This defense is just the most annoying, pesky, whatever name you want to term it. Like, their defense is just too much. And whoever goes to the NBA Finals to face them, it's going to be a great matchup because, like, I just think that this defense could be one of the best defenses we've seen. And I don't want to overvalue
prisoner of the moment.
Yeah, prisoner of the moment. That's what I was looking for. Prisoner of the moment. But Boston's defense was great, but this defense is next level, man.
Well, the one thing about those other defenses, in my opinion, they weren't as aggressive in turning you over. Those defenses were great because they had switchability, right? Everybody tries to switch in today's defense, even if you ain't got no business switching. You don't want to fight over a screen. Oh, let's just switch. And then all of a sudden you switch. And then that's how players get hunted because you switch so easy. Hey, there's no mark out there. There's nobody you can say,
who are you hunting?
We're going to take advantage of this player today. You know what I mean? Like, we're not taking advantage of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and try to get him in foul trouble because he going to get us in foul trouble. There's none of that. Everybody's capable.
Yeah.
Then you bring in the Kayson Wallace's off the bench, Alex Caruso, who I just mentioned, off the bench. And then if you manage to, it's almost like Ocean's 11. Remember the first Ocean's 11? It was like, and they were displaying how hard it was to get inside the vault. And you're like, what? After the security guards, after this. And then you have this vault that we don't have the code to. Yeah. And we're going to get in and rob it. That is what this looks like. At the end of that, Titus, if you get past Caruso and J-Dub and Dort, who plays like a football player, and that's in a good and bad way, right? Yeah. I say that in all the good and bad ways. Let's say you get past those dudes. Who you got waiting on you?
Chet and Hardenstein. Hardenstein, you know what I'm saying?
How do you score?
You can't do it. Yeah. As Ant said at the end of the game, man, he was like 15 puppets on a string. That was what it was. They were all in sync, online. They knew their assignments. And I think we're going to talk about the Knicks later, I assume.
Yes.
But it's interesting to see how Tibbs decides to go to these obscure lineups in the playoffs, literally the Eastern Conference Finals, where Mark Dagnall's been experimenting all season long. They caught some bad L's in the course of the season. He's like, I'm not worried about it. We're experimenting for the long run. They know what lineups to play and what to do, what adjustments to make against specific opponents. And it's just a masterclass on how to manage your roster throughout the regular season, take that seriously, and then, you know, use that motivation into the... I heard the question that you asked, like, when did you guys know... I think that was you. When did you guys know that you guys were this caliber of a team? And J-Dub was like, really, in the playoffs. And they took the regular season seriously. Then they're like, okay, we know what we need to do. We have all of the pieces together. Now we just got to execute. And that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, I was very curious at just a general thought, right? Of when did it click for you guys? And they were pretty much like, oh, the regular season is kind of an exhibition. That's kind of what he was saying in this way of like, yeah, we had 68 wins, but we didn't know how good we were until we played Denver. And it's kind of like graduating. Like, you figured it out now. You played Denver. Mm-hmm. You blew them out in the game 7. You gave one game away. You probably might have gave away game 3-2 on the road.
Yeah.
But you really gave away game 1. But up until now, and I struggle with this, Titus, because I'm going inside my own head right now. I don't have any notes. But I'm thinking since 1990, okay? No, I'll stretch it back. I'll stretch it 2 years back. The 89 Pistons went 15-2 in the postseason. This is before, like, the three-point shot was really prevalent, so you're not going to have wide point differentials, right? Right. The 91 Bulls, the first Bulls championship team, extremely dominant. Lost one game in the conference semifinals, lost one game in the NBA finals, Magic to Sam Perkins. The 96 Bulls, I want to say, yeah, the 72-win Bulls, lost one game to the Knicks, lost two to Seattle after going up 3-0. And then there's like a bunch of nothing, and then you got the 2001 Lakers, right? After that, I don't feel like there has been this super dominant playoff team. Boston was really dominant last year, but they didn't play a top seed in the finals. And no. neither will the Oklahoma City Thunder, right?
Yeah.
But I feel like this ranks above, or this ranks in the conversation of that Lakers team in 2001, of some of those aforementioned teams over the last 40 years, where we're like, this team is so dominant. Like, you, the numbers say it, right? Four wins by 30-plus points this postseason. That's tied for number one. And you are the youngest team to ever get to, or second youngest team, to ever get to the NBA Finals. We have not seen anything like this ever before.
No, we haven't. And I think that that just speaks to Sam Presti, man. Like, this, how was this team a 24-win team 3 years ago? They're now the youngest team in, what, 50 years to reach the post, to reach the NBA Finals. I'm at a loss for words for how good this team is and how young it is, because it's scary to know that they got 15 first-round picks until 2031. 14 of their 15 guys are under contract through next season. Their oldest player is Alex Caruso at 32. In an era in the CBA that we thought that dynasties could be broken or be really hard to create one, they seem very well set up to be a dynasty.
It's
if
funny,
they can get this done.
Because I think they're going to win. I think they're going to win the NBA Finals.
I do too.
I want to sit there with you for a second. And because last year, when the Celtics ran through everyone, right? Went up 3-0 against Dallas, won that series easily, smashed everybody. And we said, Boston's going to be here, Tatum and Brown, for a long time. Not discounting the fact, Dan, that they had been there for a long time. This was just the first year that they had gotten over the hump. And we assumed that, okay, you've gotten the championship, you got your 65 wins or whatever it was last year. Now you're just going to cruise for the next two or three, and you're going to be dynastic. I want to make sure we stay in the moment with this Thunder team, because while I'm with you, Chet Holmgren still got room to grow. J-Dub still got room to grow. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander still got – he can still smooth out some parts of his game, I suppose, at 26. But just sitting in the moment here, I think that's why we didn't say – man, they're going to be good right now. Because we were looking far ahead. We were saying they got all these draft picks and all this draft capital that they can flip into other guys in case they got to trade J-Dub. In case, you know what I'm saying, you have to trade somebody else, you can use the draft capital to go get a max player on maybe the back end or something like that, and the game just rewinds. I think the NBA is very surprised that they're here right now.
Yeah, I think it's – so I think we were talking about a few weeks ago, but I think this is the best example of exercising patience, because they could have – Presti could have made a move at some point and been like, I don't have time to, like, wait for other people to develop. The one move he made was Alex Caruso for Josh Giddey.
Josh Giddey, yep. Yep.
And you can say – and once spend one free agent budget on Isaiah Hartenstein.
Mm-hmm.
But – for how much, you know, I was just listening to the post game of, you know, SGA talking about winning, you know, the Western Conference Finals MVP. And this team is just so connected in terms of their joy for the game, their joy for each other, playing for each other. Like, it just seems like that culture that's been built over those losing seasons to come this quickly to this moment is pretty shocking. So to your point, I agree with you. Like, I don't think anyone expected it. And you can go around all of the pundits in the media Twitter sphere was talking about, oh, Thunder's not ready. They're too young. They're not ready. They haven't gone through anything. I don't know. It's hard to say, but like, we've just been underrating and discounting them all season long, even though they've been clearly the best team. they continue to just smash everyone on their home floor. They have the best defense. They have the MVP. What more do you need? Like, and it's crazy because, like, I don't even know now. Like, they don't need to go get somebody. Right. Like, their squad is thorough, all up and down.
Yeah, I'm fascinated at, because I'll be honest with you. I think some people within the Thunder weren't exactly sure that this was going to be the year that they did it, even as early as, you know, two rounds ago. You know, they were saying, hey, we still got growing to do. We still got to figure some stuff out. So I think to some degree, they may not be surprised, but I think they were open to the possibility that this year doesn't have to be the year quite yet, except it is, and they're not going anywhere, and they look as dominant as any team as we have seen in the past at least 5 or 6 years. Like, oh, let me forget that before the Steph Curry fans come after my ass. The 16-17 Warriors that didn't lose a single game until, I think, game 4 of the NBA Finals against the Cleveland Cavaliers, the first Steph KD iteration, which might very well be the very best team that we will ever see in our lifetime. That team was so unfair, I forgot about them when I was talking about dominant teams. My bad. Yeah. Don't shoot me, right? Now let's talk about the Timberwolves, because I think they are such a fascinating team. Julius Randle, who up until a week ago, you were like, oh, shoot, he's going to opt out and get all of his money and get a raise, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got Julius at 30 years old. Rudy Gobert will be 33 next year. Mike Conley will be 38 next year. That's three of your 8 rotation players. It don't take a lot, in my opinion, for you to go from being a team with a young star to a team with older pieces that you got to figure out what to do with. Rudy's on an extension, below market extension, you know, below what people thought he was going to sign for, which kicks in next year. You got Randle and Naz Reid, who can get out of their,
right.
Randle's got a $30 million decision to make. Naz Reid should get out of his contract. He's making 15 next year. He can go for a lot more. When I look at this Timberwolves team, when you look at this Timberwolves team, do you see internal growth from the Terrence Shannons of the world, the Rob Dillinghams of the world, even the Anthony Edwards of the world, or do you see a team that needs some roster change before they move forward?
Yeah, I think the first one, I don't know if they'll be able to re-sign Nikhil Alexander Walker. Like, I think did enough.
Yeah.
And he's a key rotational piece, to your point. They need to upgrade, and I feel for Mike Conley because he finally got to the Western Conference Finals, and it seemed like Ant was very disappointed that he couldn't get further with Mike. It seems like the whole team is rallied around, you know, we got to do this for Mike. But fact is, Mike just isn't the player that he was, man. He's getting too old. So they need somebody else that can create offensively and break down because they're ultimately going to be facing the Oklahoma City Thunder again. So I don't know what piece needs to move. I would hope that it wouldn't be Jaden McDaniels because I think he's a player that has shown a lot of growth in this postseason. I would love to see him get more opportunities as a scorer. Perhaps that lightens the load for Ant as well going forward, but they're going to have to make some kind of move. And I don't know, maybe it is. I think Julius Randle probably opts into his player option. Maybe get his, I don't know. He played so well in the first two series. I'm like, was that enough to get a raise in the offseason?
Right, right.
And if he doesn't come back, then I think you have a lot of wiggle room in terms of like, how can we readjust this roster? Cause you're not having to pay him, you know, $31 million. I think I'm at the point where like they have the pieces of the core. I think they're going to keep Naz Reid around. I think they'll give him an extension. Dante DiVincenzo's fine. I'll keep him there. Rudy Gobert is a big question mark because I don't know that he necessarily needs to be the anchor of this defense. Like, he was good, but he wasn't great. Like, he won that Lakers series in that game where he put up 20-20. Never saw that again. But I don't know that that's at that age and where the league is going, whether you need him to be a catalyst of your defense. He's good, but I think that could be a trade piece that maybe can net you something else, and then you rock with Naz Reid as your starting center.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by how they view things moving forward because, you know, they gave up so much to get Rudy Gobert, right?
So much.
And you heard the name Kevin Durant bandied about with that franchise. And Kevin Durant is going to have a lot of suitors, and he's going to have the choice. And we know how Anthony Edwards feels about Kevin Durant, right? Rudy Gobert's deal de-escalates every year up until 28, which is also a player option for $38 million. So while, and that sounds like a lot, look, whenever you're getting into being close to the first apron, second apron, you're spending money, period. You're, whether you spend it on Rudy or you spend it somewhere else, you're spending money. I agree with you that maybe Conley needs to be de-emphasized just a little bit. Like, you felt for him. You could just see, like, the hurt on his face. Like, mixed in with the jubilation of everything that we saw or that you were hearing. Like, it's weird, Titus. You're in this arena. You're in this big cavernous place. And the players in the locker room are silent, or how are they feeling? And you can hear the dull roar of the celebration behind you. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, from a human standpoint, you're like, this is wild. Like, you can't even sit quietly with your thoughts. I was thinking about Mike Conley with that. You know, and even Chris Finch was like, you know, maybe it doesn't happen for him as a player. Maybe it happens for him as a coach. Maybe it happens for him as a GM. You know, that sort of thing. How long does he want to play? Mm-hmm. Can you get someone, another playmaker, in there that can make the game easier for Anthony Edwards? Too many times, Ant was staring down the barrel of a defense that he was at the top of the key. There was one boxes and elbows, right? They were protecting the paint. There's some growth that has to happen in Ant's game, right? He became a better crazy good three-point shooter this year, right? Probably became too good of a three-point shooter this year at the expense of other things. So, yeah, true. To the point of, is the playmaker going to be Dante DiVincenzo? Is the playmaker going to be Rob Dillingham, who they drafted in the first round last year and didn't get a chance to play much this year? You wonder if the growth is going to be internal. But focusing on Ant, playing with his back to the basket is something. Being able to play in those other spots of the floor, the spots that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has made his home, that's probably the difference between the two players. But also, and I want to say this to you, Anthony Edwards is 23 years old. We got to slow down on pretending as if he is 33 or pretending as if he is 28. And it's almost like him getting to the Western Conference Finals 2 years in a row. It's been a bad thing because now we're saying, well, nah, he's not good enough. And why isn't he heartbroken? And blah, blah, blah. He's 23. Next year, he's going to be 24. We got to relax. Yeah.
It's like the same energy that Tatum was getting before he went on to five straight Eastern Conference Finals, right? It's the same, like, when is LeBron gonna get over the hump? Like, it's similar conversations. And I think I appreciate how honest Ant is. And he said he's gonna be working, no one's gonna be working harder than him this summer. I believe that. I mean, just the growth in his game from a three-point perspective from last year was a crazy leap. So imagine one thing that Finch was saying after the games that he thinks that and could get better against physicality. So, you know, him being able to operate in the mid-range, it seemed like the Thunder wanted to make him a mid-range jump shooter. And if he doesn't have that package, like, his footwork is good. It's not great. Like, SGA's is great, elite. So he's going to have to get into the bag of how can I operate, break down defenses, and get different looks. That's not just either me, I can only get to the basket, or I got to shoot this three. I think that was what was pretty much limiting his game. He couldn't find other ways to score. And maybe that is even going off ball more, being more of a slasher, being more active than just kind of standing around and waiting for the ball and waiting for things to happen to then make a move, being more reactionary instead of proactive.
Yeah, that's definitely playing off the ball, being able to move. I thought he did a great job of getting off the ball. Like, he wasn't holding, making it passes off time, off target. I think the problem was once he made the pass, he wasn't relocating.
Right.
You get the eyes of the defense somewhere else, you wind up relocating, and then you can attack off of closeouts and put yourself in an advantageous situation where your athleticism and your smarts, he's a smart ball player, takes over. You know, so there's a lot of questions there. I'm very fascinated with what Julius Randle does. I think Jaden McDaniels, you made a great point. If he gets his handle together, and I know that's a big if, because if you don't got a handle by year five, you're probably not going to have a handle. But if he gets a handle together and can facilitate more offense, you've got a real runway for an Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels sort of two-way players at both, you know, at those swing positions that can really make you formidable. Because like you said, you're going to be seeing the Oklahoma City Thunder for the next 4 to 5 years. Who knows how good they'll be, if they'll be at 68 wins every single year, if it will look exactly like this. But they're going to be here, and you're going to have to see some iteration of Lu Dort, Jalen Williams, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You have to be able to fight fire with fire.
Facts. Yeah, I think the Minnesota Timberwolves are in a pretty good spot comparatively to other teams. Like, at least they have their star. They have a couple role players to play off those stars. But some change is coming. I'm just curious to see what's out there on the market. And who do you think is their biggest trade asset if they were to go get a playmaker? And like I said, they didn't think that Rob Dillingham was ready, and they want to go get somebody to go play point guard. Who do you think who would you dangle?
It probably would be Jaden McDaniels would be there. I don't know if I would dangle him, but he's the player that everybody would ask for.
Right.
Most certainly.
Right.
He's the guy that people would say, you know what? He's 24 years old. He plays. He's on a reasonable contract. When I read off the numbers, 23 this year, 25 next year, 27 and 27, 28 and 28, 30 and 29. Like, those sound like ridiculous numbers, but as the cap keeps going up and his salary isn't tied to the cap because it's not going up by percentages. He's now on a 30% max. He's on a 35% max or anything like that. Those numbers are going to stay flat as the cap continues to go up. That contract is going to look more and more affordable. Even if you think that he's not the great player that he could be, you're still going to get great value for him.
Exactly.
That's what makes him attractive, but that's what makes me want to keep him. Like, I want to keep Naz Reid.
Yeah.
Do you know Julius Randle was that a blip with how he played in the last 36 games of the regular season when he was there, and in the playoffs where he dominated Draymond Green, dominated LeBron James, and just had bad games at the worst time against a really good team? If we're going to say the Thunder are a historic team, they're going to make really good players look bad. But we got to have villains. That's all. We got to have villains. Somebody's got to be wrong. Somebody's got to be jacked up. Somebody's got to fail. That's just what this is. But when we come back, we got to talk about real failure, as in New York failure. Welcome back to The Good Word, here with Dan Titus. Dan, game 5, New York Pacers tonight. The Pacers can clinch a trip to the NBA Finals, their first trip since 2000. They're one of these ABA teams that came over. They won in the ABA. They won in the ABA. They didn't win in the NBA. They've gone to the finals one time. Tyrese Haliburton has them on the doorstep. We can focus on them a little bit later. We can talk about the New York Knicks, though. Because we can talk about Karl Towns, how he looks with that knee contusion that had him limping around toward the end of game 4. Jalen Brunson, I think I look at those two players, and Cat always gets off when Brunson's on the bench. And when you have those two guys who are not defensively inclined in your starting lineup, I don't know what any coach could do. Like, Tibbs is going to take some hell and some heat for them, especially if they lose in 5, but they lose tonight at home where they have not been exceptionally well. If they not played, exceptionally well. Tibbs is going to take some heat for this, but I don't know how much heat he should take when you consider Brunson and Towns are not good defenders. The Pacers are just a perfect matchup for them in a way that they spread them out and they cannot play catch up at all with the Pacers.
Yeah, I don't know what more Tibbs can do. And this kind of goes back to an earlier point of you should have done something early in the regular season to understand what your personnel was and how you can tweak with lineups, not try something and just, you know, throw something at the wall and hope that it sticks, because that's what it kind of feels like. So when you throw out DeLon Wright and you throw out, you know, Precious Achiuwa for these random minutes in game 4, it's like, I just don't understand where that coaching scheme comes from. It just seems like you're just trying new things to try to make it work. And I think that's a little bit too late in the game to be doing that. That said, I think it's pretty evident that Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns, their minutes need to be staggered a little bit more, because whenever they're on the floor together, obviously they both get hunted. But then at the same time, when they're on the bench, I think that there's a pretty glaring need for someone to be able to score. And it's not going to be Mikal Bridges, because he just refuses to take any shots that's not a fadeaway. So, yeah.
He fades away on layups. We got to say, no, y'all, we got to say something about this. That man fades away on layups. Like, there
Fast break layups.
Fast break. I think it's almost something mental at this point. Like, the hitch in his jumper at the start of the season that we thought really was going to hinder him, he wound up kind of figuring that part out, right? But the fact that he's not going in and taking any type of level of contact, and he had a lot of shots late in game four, open shots where they were running plays for him as opposed to running plays for anybody else, and it was, and he wasn't able to deliver. And the thing that's going to stick with Knicks fans, 5 first-round picks. You are the guy that we trade. We didn't even give up this much for OG Anunoby, who's a better ball player than you, who's an all-defense type of player, who's not coming up short. Like, OG, I think, has played reasonably well. He's had some moments where, yeah, maybe Pascal Siakam has gotten the better of him, but he's had some moments where he's bullied some guys, too. Bridges is the one that, to me, looks out of sorts. And because he's getting lit up also by Tyrese Haliburton, who's having his way with him, when Tyrese Haliburton is not getting the switch on Jalen Brunson, he's become glaring and into focus, even more so than Josh Hart, who's coming off the bench, even more so than Karl Towns, who's always going to be sort of under scrutiny. It seems like, to me, every single New York Knicks is catching hell right now for not being good enough, when maybe they weren't good enough to begin with as a unit. Has anybody ever considered that?
I mean, they're not NBA finals worthy. I mean, it just doesn't seem like a complete team to me. Like, their starting lineup has just been, they've just been so reliant on their starting lineup for so long. Eventually something's going to break. That's what happened last year. They're fortunate that nothing's happened yet. And I think that this, when you look at both teams on both sides of the conferences between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the Indiana Pacers, these are 9-man, 10-man rotations, and they don't lose a step or a beat when those guys come in there. And so, yeah, I think that the roster is just flawed, and it's something that we talked about weeks ago. Was like, what would it take for the Knicks to have to make a move? Like, say, if Giannis becomes available, even though he said he hasn't officially made that known yet. I think we've seen enough. I've seen enough that this iteration of Bridges, OG, Cat, whatever, is not an NBA championship caliber team. You got to go get somebody else that can raise that tide. And I think that you got to, yeah, you, if Giannis or somebody like that becomes available, I wouldn't say Kevin Durant. I don't know that he's the right fit. But Giannis, I would make a play for that, because this team is, it just doesn't have enough outside of Brunson in the clutch moments. And whenever Cat is out of foul trouble, it's great. But he just has that, I don't know what it is about Cap. He can't get out of his own way. He has these moments where he takes over, but then he'll just take himself out of the game with some stupid foul. And that kind of lack of discipline is not going to get you to a championship. And call it Tibbs problems, call it defensive woes or not having enough depth. There's just a whole bunch of problems that I think it's pretty glaring that the Knicks need to do something else.
It's amazing that they've gotten this far. I think we need to say that. And this is not me saying this as the guy from Detroit. But let's be honest.
And you got the 313 clearly on your sweatshirt there.
It's a clothing brand. It ain't got no Pistons logo on it. You know what I mean? Like, let's be honest. So as we say that, Isaiah Stewart and Jaden Ivey didn't play at all. Jaden Ivey didn't play at all. Hadn't played since January. Isaiah Stewart played in game one, didn't hardly play after that. They probably don't get out of that series if the Pistons are whole. And we're having a much different conversation about this entire thing. But I think this is good for the Knicks in the long run, because it lays bare all the things. I think it's laying bare, man, Jalen Brunson, he's a lot like Harden and Luka Doncic in the way that he is so ball dominant that it's, the numbers look great, especially in crunch time, right? But is that the way that you want to play? Is that the way... is that level of ball dominance playing at that spot on the floor and being reliant on contact and everything else, is that the way that you can win a championship? I've always said no, right? I've always said, and the fact that if you're going to have him and Karl Towns, Karl Towns gets off when Jalen's off the floor, not because the two don't have requisite chemistry, which they may not, but they operate on the same spots of the floor.
Right.
Karl catches at the top of the key. Karl catches top left of the key. Where does left-handed Jalen Brunson have the ball at? The same exact spots. And because Jalen Brunson's going to dribble the ball and not going to be the guy running off, you know, staggers and everything else and making the defense account for him, he's going to dribble, then your offense is not going to look like that. Compared to the Indiana Pacers, where if we look at Tyrese Halliburton, who looks like, you know, prototypical point guard, but he spends a lot of time off the ball, right? With Nembhard there and with TJ McConnell there. Like, he spends enough time off of it where he can come and get it and then get off of it once again to find Pascal Siakam, to find Miles Turner, to be able to make plays from different parts of the floor makes your offense so much more dangerous rather than you're staring down the barrel at the top of the key, begging Jalen Brunson to save you or begging Karl Towns to get hot from 25 feet. It's a recipe that does not equal success. And I think that's where the Knicks have to look really at team roster construction and say, did we build this team the right way?
Yeah, there's just way too much dependency on Brunson to play hero ball or Karl Anthony Towns to supplement that. And I think you're right. I think you can liken it to a James Harden, Luka kind of situation in terms of, like, are you stifling the offensive development by having so much dominant ball control by one person? And I think Bridges was brought in there to be a 3-and-D spacer. Like, he was supposed to be a complimentary guy that can get you those buckets whenever Brunson got in trouble. And I think OG Anunoby's growth has been more substantial than Bridges. So, yeah, I don't think Bridges has been worth the value of his trade yet. And I think that's something that the Knicks are going to have to look forward to. Like, do we come off of this, or can he get better and improve in certain ways that it's going to make this team better? Or is he going to be more of the same? Because to me, it seems like he's kind of just Brooklyn Bridges, and he forgot about how to play defense a little bit. And the shot selection, I mean, he's actually, as I'm looking at his shot chart, like, he's actually above league average in the playoffs around the rim. He just doesn't take those shots enough. And I don't know if that's the yips or some version of the yips, as you were talking about. But, like, his shot profile has changed since the days that he was in Phoenix. And if you could go back to that guy, then I think maybe they'd have a little bit more success and less reliance on Brunson, because he could step up. But I don't, at this stage, we've seen it all year long. And I don't know that this is something that we can confidently bank on going forward. Like, oh, this Knicks team is going to be able to do things in its current construct. Because, as you said, like, I had to lose him to the Pistons in the first round anyway. So,
right.
And then Jason Tatum goes and tears his Achilles. So, like, things have been breaking the perfect way for the Knicks to get to this point. And now I just think that they're facing a dose of reality.
Breaking in the perfect way for them to lose in five games to a team that's not Boston or Cleveland. Like, Mikal Bridges in 163 minutes in this series is going to the line seven times.
He was doing that in the regular season, too. Like, he shot, like, less than two free throws a game. Like, that's unacceptable.
Apparently, it is acceptable in New York because they tolerating it. When we come back, we got the last word for you. It's time for the last word here with Dan Titus. I wrote this and I was thinking about it, Dan, last night as the Thunder clinched. First NBA Finals since 2012. That was Durant, Westbrook, Harden. Last night was 9 years to the day of the Klay Thompson game. Game 6 of the 2016 Western Conference Finals. Thunder were up 3-1. Then they were up 3-2. They had a chance to close out the 73-win Warriors at home. And then Klay Thompson went berserk. That day led to all the events, I think, that has happened to get them back here. You lose Kevin Durant. You get Russell Westbrook, the MVP stuff, and blah, blah, blah. You get Carmelo, Paul George. And then those trades wind up netting you Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Those other trades wind up netting you the draft picks that become Jalen Williams and some of these other guys. And it's not going to erase the memory of Game 6, Clay, and everything. It's not going to erase the memory of Kevin Durant leaving. But I think this looks like the best Thunder team that I've seen, period. It doesn't feel like it because you're like, man, that's Kevin Durant, that's James Harden, that's Russell Westbrook over there. But I feel like the combustibility factor of that team, where maybe they were a little happy getting to the finals. Maybe as young as they weren't as mature as this group is, even though this group seems to be is younger by the numbers. I feel like this team, I don't know if they beat the brakes off the 2016 Thunder or the 2012 Thunder, but they beat them, and I think they beat them good.
So which team do you think is better, 2012 or 2016 Thunder?
I would say 2012 because you do have James Harden, who single-handedly put out the San Antonio Spurs in the Western Conference Finals after going down 2-0. That Spurs team was really good. That Spurs team won 20 straight games from the end of the regular season to the postseason and went up 2-0. And Scott Brooks decided, man, let me run James Harden on this pin down. And they had no counter for it. And James Harden became fourth quarter guy in ways that we have not seen James Harden turning the fourth quarter guy in games of stakes since then. So I will say the 2012 just because you have that diversity. But there's a better Kevin Durant in 2016.
True.
Theoretically, a better Russell Westbrook in 2016. But there's still the combustibility of both of those players in big moments. Whereas you don't think Shai's not going to melt down. J-Dub's not going to melt down. Chet ain't going to melt down. Not in those big moments.
Yeah, I feel like I actually thought that the 2012 team was probably the best version of the Thunder at that point, too. Your recall is insane, by the way. But
yeah, there's something wrong with me. That's all.
But I think the difference is, like, I think offensively, the current iteration of the Thunder stack up pretty well against the 2012. I'd say maybe you give a slight edge to the 2012 team, but the difference on the defensive end to me is the stark difference for me of this current Thunder team. And I think this Thunder team defensively is by far better than the 2016 and 2012. So when stacking up that, I think that this version of the Thunder is the best version that we've seen of the Thunder in the history of their franchise. And I think that will be cemented when they win the championship. It's kind of easy to just look at defensive rating and be like, oh, this team was better defensively. But I think it's the way that they're doing it and the significance of the leap of SGA and the complimentary players like Jalen Williams. So like in 2012, Russ was, you know, getting votes for MVP. Jalen Williams there's no other person getting votes for MVP on this on this Thunder team. The role players and the depth of that team to me now seems better than the depth that they had in 2012. Because I'm looking at the roster now, it's like, what? Serge Ibaka was a defensive player of the year caliber player at that point. Kendrick Perkins was still very good. But then you go Nick Collison, Daquan Cook, Thabo Sefolosha was a good player, but Thabo, Nazi Muhammad, Reggie Jackson, Derek Fisher. Yeah, looking at the bottom end of that bench, like, give me Caruso, you know what I'm saying? Cason Wallace, those guys to me are making more impactful. They're giving more impactful minutes to me than that team did at that point in time.
Yeah, I think, and this kind of goes, this is a little weird because we tend to forget the small details. Like, just like we kind of forgot Boston's road up until last year, that Tatum and Brown had been in 5 out of 7, you know, Eastern Conference Finals. They made it to the finals. They had just been knocking on the door and then they finally got there. 2012, or let's say 2011, right? The Thunder make it to the Western Conference Finals. They lose to Dirk in 5. And that great Dallas team that went on to win the whole thing. 2012, you just talked about it. Went to the finals. Have home court advantage against the Miami Heat, against the best of LeBron and Wade and all those guys. Have home court advantage.
Tough squad.
And tough squad. And lose all three games in the 2-3-2. In other words, league, bring back the 2-3-2. That's all I'm going to say. Y'all listening, bring back 2-3-2. 2013, that was the year that Russell Westbrook got ran into by Pat Beverly along the sidelines. That team was the best team in the NBA. I firmly believe that. That team was the best team in the NBA up until that moment. I think they were headed towards a rematch with Miami. Who knows what would have happened, but that derailed them. In 2014, they lose in six in overtime to the Spurs team that had won like 64 games. Kawhi was coming into his own. Tim Duncan, remember when he was walking off the floor in Oklahoma City and they were like, you know, how do you think you're going to do against Miami? He said, yeah, we're going to beat them this time. Like that was one of the great Spurs teams ever. And then the next year, Kevin Durant has the Lisfranc injury, the first foot injury that cost them a spot in the playoffs altogether. And we just told you what happened in 2016 with the Warriors. They had a great run and could never get over the top with Durant and Westbrook and Presti running the show and maybe switching some pieces around. This team is going to get over the hump. Whether this team hangs around for as long as that team hung around, I tend to believe they will. But I think it is this franchise's time. It is this team's time. I think they're going to win it. And for the sake of all involved, I hope it's a sweep.
let's keep Vinny out of OKC. Let's have him spend the least amount of time in OKC as possible. I think that the timelines are actually pretty interesting too, because you know SGA, he's in what is sixth, seventh year in the league now.
Yeah.
That's right around the time where Durant was getting his MVP considerations as well. The youth of Westbrook and James Harden in that moment, he got, I think 2012, James Harden got Sixth Man of the Year, right? And then after that, he bounced. So I don't think that, and that's also, I think the difference of the teams is that I think that there was more individual egos to manage that you saw could have some fracture. Whereas like with this current iteration, I don't see that fracture happening. Everyone's okay with being a co-star or a co-pilot in the current situation.
It's just
situation.
Different person. It's far different personalities, and I think the Thunder, and I think the Thunder organization, Sam Presti and those guys are better equipped to handle guys now in ways that they were not equipped to handle them back then. Even though it's still sort of the same program, there's going to be, you know, some different things that you're going to do to make guys not feel like that they're being boxed in here.
Right.
So, congrats to the Thunder.
That's interesting. That was kind of like a lesson learned opportunity. Like that, I don't know that many franchises learn that quickly too, right?
Well, when you're forced to learn those lessons when one of the greatest free agent defections ever happens on your watch after making the Western Conference Finals, you better take a look in the mirror. They have, and they had to take a step back, and they did it during a time where people did not think that they would be able to get back, and they've gotten back here, and they're better than ever, which is wild to consider, considering the team that we thought they had would never get any better. So you give Sam Presti a whole lot of credit. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my man Dan Titus. Gonna see you again next week during the finals. Dan, good to see you, my man.
You too, Vin.
Thanks to Dan Titus for joining us today. Thanks to producer Dakota and the entire team that worked so hard behind the scenes on this show. I'll be back next week for another episode of The Good Word as we begin to preview the NBA Finals. Until then, everybody be safe.